This is Ron Stockton. I want to talk to you today about Charles Darwin. Well, not exactly about Charles Darwin, but about why evolution is such a controversial issue in the United States. It definitely is not an issue in other Western countries. I think we Americans have a unique situation. Let's take this podcast through two stages. First, for background, I want to discuss with you the Scopes Trial of 1925. This is commonly called the Scopes Monkey Trial. Then I want to read to you a paper I presented at a conference in Dearborn. It was the Muslimish Conference on Religion and Science. Muslimish is an organization of questioning Muslims, trying to reassess how Islam fits into the modern world and how they fit within Islam. I've been to three of their conferences and have found them very thoughtful. This issue really exploded in 1925 in Tennessee when a biology teacher named John Scopes intentionally violated the law restricting the teaching of evolution. When the famous defense attorney Clarence Darrow volunteered to defend Scopes, the former Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan volunteered to lead the prosecution. Darrow was a civil libertarian who saw a threat to intellectual freedom. Bryan's views were more complex. The defense of religion was one issue, but that shared prominence with other issues of power, domination, and even potential genocide. To Bryan, Darwin's book, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, published in 1859, had inherent in it an ideology that the elimination of weaker members of a species, or even whole races, as ethnic groups were called, was logical, progressive, inevitable, and therefore good. The concept of survival of the fittest, a term coined by Herbert Spencer and adopted by Darwin, seemed inherently dangerous. The ideology of Darwinism seemed to suggest that whatever was scientifically possible was desirable. Bryan said of this, "Science has proven itself an evil genius." Anticipating Churchill's later reference to Nazism as the dark abyss of perverted science, Darwin's views also converged with Malthus, who warned of the dangers of overpopulation as the poor bred the world into destruction. Bryan, the great commoner, who resigned as Wilson's Secretary of State rather than preside over war, was not about to stand aside and watch the weak be discounted or crushed, or see human life treated as an inconvenience. Bryan feared that sooner or later, whole peoples would be targeted for extermination. To him, the core issue was not science, which he did not dispute, but Darwinism as an ideology linked to elitist social policy and the power of the privileged classes. Bryan was a devoted Christian reformer. As he put it, if civilization is not saved from the wreckage threatened by intelligence not consecrated by love, it must be saved by the moral code of the meek and lowly Nazarene, obviously a reference to Jesus. He felt that the evolutionary hypothesis discourages those who labor for the improvement of man's condition. Let me read you some passages that illustrate some of the arguments. First, an excerpt from Malthus, 1798, in his essay on the principle of population, opposing food subsidies. "There is one right which man is generally thought to possess, which I am confident he neither does nor can possess, a right to subsistence, when his labor will not fairly purchase it. Our laws indeed say that he has the right and bind the society to furnish employment and food to those who cannot get them in the regular market. But in so doing, they attempt to reverse the law of nature." Then Darwin, upon reading Malthus in 1838, reported in his autobiography, "I happened to read Malthus on population, and being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence, which everywhere goes on from long continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result of this would be the formation of a new species. Here, then, I had at last got a theory by which to work. Then there is Darwin in The Descent of Man in 1871 on why extermination is natural. At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, even than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as a baboon, instead of as now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla. Another excerpt from The Descent of Man. Bryan quoted this passage at the trial. With savages, the weak in body or mind are soon eliminated, and those that survive commonly exhibit a vigorous state of health. We civilized men, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbeciles, the maimed, and the sick. We institute poor laws, and our medical men exert their utmost skill to save the life of everyone to the last moment. There is reason to believe that vaccination has preserved thousands who from a weak constitution would formerly have succumbed to smallpox. Thus, the weak members of the civilized society propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of men. It is surprising how soon a want of care, or care wrongly directed, leads to the degeneration of a domestic race. But excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. Before we turn to my talk at the conference, let me mention a couple of sources. Most of the Darwin quotes are from Mr. Bryan's last speech in the memoirs of William Jennings Bryan, written by Mrs. Bryan after her husband's death. Other quotes are from Marilyn Robinson, Darwinism, an essay, in The Death of Adam. A standard academic work is Edward J. Larson, Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial, and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. It won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize. Note today, by the way, that in Dayton, there is a very popular creationism museum that shows humans walking side by side with dinosaurs. All right, here's my talk to the Muslimis Conference on Islam and Science. It's slightly modified for this podcast. When I was first invited to speak to this conference, I declined. I thought, what do I know about religion and science? And anyway, the focus is on Islam, and I'm not a Muslim. But then I realized that there was a famous case in this country's history that might serve as an example of the complexities of the topic. And I had read on that topic and felt comfortable speaking about it, so I accepted. The case is one that many of you will know. It involves a young teacher named John Scopes. Tennessee had passed a law prohibiting the teaching of evolution in the schools, and Scopes decided to violate the law so it could be challenged in the courts. He went to his principal and told him he would be teaching evolution in his science class. He did, and was duly charged and ordered to pay a fine. But before that, something amazing happened. Clarence Darrow, the most famous defense attorney in the country and a great advocate of civil liberties and free expression, and a critic of religion, I might note, offered to defend Scopes pro bono. Now we had a small-town prosecutor facing a legal giant. Soon William Jennings Bryan, the courageous populist and champion of the poor, who had been the presidential nominee of the Democratic Party three times, offered to lead the prosecution. Soon reporters from all over the country descended upon Dayton. One was H.L. Mencken of Baltimore, who brought his small-town anti-Protestant, anti-evangelical prejudices to Tennessee. He was a bombastic and popular writer who portrayed Bryan and his admirers as characterized by ignorance, backwardness, inbreeding, superstition, and a host of other bad things. It was Mencken who turned the word fundamentalist into a derogatory term. Up until that time, the word simply meant an affirmation of what were called the fundamentals of the faith. Most Christians adhere to those fundamentals: that Jesus was the Son of God, that Mary was a virgin, that Jesus rose from the dead, that Christ would return to earth, that the biblical miracles had actually happened, and that the Bible was the Word of God. Now the word fundamentalist became a polemical insult that meant backward, stupid, bigoted, not intelligent, not educated, not worthy of respect. Today it sometimes means violent. I have to admit before we go on that as an undergraduate, I read Mencken's essays and was taken by his iconoclasm. Even now I have two of his books. The one on the American language is really fascinating. I recommend it. What Scopes had done was similar to what Jesus had done when he healed a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. That story is found in Mark 3, if you're interested. The religious authorities, with their strict interpretations of religious text, were standing there when he did the deed. He first asked them if any thought it was a sin to do a good deed on the Sabbath. The rules, as they interpreted them, were unequivocal. You were not supposed to perform any act on the Sabbath. The actions of Jesus were confrontational and intentionally challenged not just the rules, but the authorities who interpreted the rules. What Scopes did was the same. He challenged the authorities and the power of the state by openly and defiantly and confrontationally defying their laws and, by definition, their authority. I myself come from a conservative evangelical culture. I try hard to understand how people think. I once had a friend point to a high school child and say the school has told her she may not believe in her religion. I asked what the issue was and was told that it was the teaching of evolution. We do not believe in evolution. It is against the Bible, I was told. Unwisely, I said that there were different meanings of what evolution means, different understandings of what evolution means. If you go to England, for example, you will see armor from the 1200s in which the great warriors of the age were not much more than 5.5 feet tall. Obviously, we have evolved, and that is not inconsistent with what the Bible teaches. Likewise, we all recognize that there are infections that would have knocked out overnight, that would have been knocked out overnight by an antibiotic, but today there are infections that are resistant because they have evolved into new strains. The weak bacteria were wiped out, but the ones that were invulnerable to antibiotics are thriving. That is the essential principle of evolution, that those with advantageous traits survive and reproduce, while others without those traits die out. But my friend had an answer to that. I know that, but that is not what we're concerned about. So what are they concerned about? Let's go back to that original law as passed by the Tennessee legislature. Few who get passionate about this issue know what it actually said. That Tennessee law did not prohibit the teaching of evolution. What it prohibited was, quote, any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals, unquote. If you want to point out that warriors in the 1200s were 5 feet 6 inches tall, or that bacteria have evolved, you can do that. What is prohibited was teaching that humans evolved from lesser beings. And why is that prohibited? Because the Bible is unequivocal about what happened on the sixth day. After creating animals, God turned to the final act of creation. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. That's first Genesis. This was a divine act, a unique act of creation, in which God created humanity and breathed a divine essence into our souls. So the issue was not really evolution. That was just the outward and visible sign of a deeper struggle. The real issue was a holy teaching about the nature of humanity and about the relationship of humans to the divine. Those who see this creation story in metaphorical terms can find many flaws with traditional religious thinking. For example, it is logically inconsistent to say that God created the sun and the moon on the fourth day if a day is defined as the rotation of the earth in the face of the sun. To such people, those who view these texts in literal terms are not following the laws and logic of science. But to someone who stands in awe of God's majesty, when the Bible says God created humanity in a separate and unique act of creation, these other points are just argumentation. And our educational structures should not challenge this. As the great academic Edward Larson said when he spoke on my campus, the real issue was not a struggle over science. It was a struggle over education. What are our children being taught? There was a critical point in the Scopes trial when Darrow did something totally unexpected. He called Bryant to the stand as an expert witness, an expert on biblical thinking. This is a critical scene in the play and film, Inherit the Wind, by Lawrence and Lee. That's a very good film and play, by the way. Darrow and Bryant had been political allies in the past, but on this issue they were bitter opponents. Darrow decided to humiliate Bryant by exposing his narrow thinking. Darrow noted that according to one calculation, the biblical creation occurred in 4004 BC. By the way, this is not biblical, it's just a calculation someone made. And yet scientific evidence found rocks that date back millions of years. How does Bryant reconcile those facts? Bryant's response was perfect. Affirming the majesty of God, he said, "I am more concerned about the Rock of Ages than the age of rocks." To Bryant's critics, this was an evasion. Darrow had trapped Bryant in his own flawed logic and exposed him for the buffoon that he was. But to Bryant and his admirers, it made a point. There are things I do not understand. But I understand that God created the universe and God created humans and placed them just below the angels. That is what the Bible says and that is what I believe. A second point, almost universally overlooked, is the summation speech that Bryant wrote to finish his defense. He never delivered it because the judge sent the case directly to the jury. But it is available to scholars who want to understand what Bryant thought was at stake. Bryant made several points in that speech, affirming the integrity of the Bible and the role of religion in stabilizing and integrating society. A secular person might not like these points. But in his own courtroom surprise, Bryant used Darrow's own words against him. He discussed the Leopold and Loeb trial, where two young men were convicted of the premeditated murder of their classmate, Bobby Franks, just to see if they could get away with it. Darrow had been the defense attorney, of Leopold, and had gotten them off with a life sentence. To Bryan, this crime shows what happens when humans put their own logic at the center of their thinking, treating other human beings as objects for their experiments. And what happens when perverted science and amoral ethics are introduced into the curriculum? The outcome, the horrible outcome, is predictable and inevitable. Bryant quoted Darrow in court. There's a full summary of Darrow's arguments in a wonderful book, Clarence Darrow for the Defense. I definitely recommend that book. Darrow had focused in that earlier trial upon arguments Nietzsche had made in his book, Ecce Homo. In that, he had discussed, quote, "the greatest of all tasks, the higher breeding of humanity, together with the remorseless destruction of all degenerate and parasitic elements." Wow, the Nazis love that phrase. Darrow had quoted Nietzsche to argue that because such things had been taught to impressionable young people, that meant all of society was somehow responsible for what they had done. As Darrow put it at the time, now this is Darrow, there is not any university in the world where the professor is not familiar with Nietzsche. Not one. If this boy is to blame for this, where did he get it? Is there any blame attached because somebody took Nietzsche's philosophy seriously and fashioned his life upon it? Your Honor, it is hardly fair to hang a 19-year-old boy for a philosophy that was taught to him at the university. And as Brian put it in Tennessee, would the state be blameless if it permitted the universities under its control to be turned into training schools for murderers? Brian asked what would happen if we applied the principles of evolution to social policy. It is one thing to say that humans evolved from a lower species, but would we next conclude that there are some human beings who are more evolved than others, and that the strong should dominate the weak? Brian was always a champion of the oppressed and marginalized. Here he saw a great threat. What would happen to the concept of all men are created equal if we reject the creation story? By the way, Thomas Jefferson had a similar concern, although not involving the creation story. Brian was concerned throughout his life with how the poor were treated by the rich and powerful. But when I discuss this in class, I sometimes tell my students that Brian did not know it, but he also was trying to head off the Holocaust. If some people are superior and others are inferior, then for the good of society, it is logical that we eliminate those who are inferior. Or, as we might put it, first they would come for the Aborigines. Then they came for the Africans. Then they would come for the Jews. And, well, whoever is next. Now I have a family story. When my wife was in her young 30s, she decided to retrain as a physical therapist. She enrolled at Wayne State University and began to take some courses, science courses, needed to apply for the physical therapy program. By the way, she got a very good education. One was a general course in biology. The professor was a young woman, pretty, blonde, well-educated, impressive in many ways. But she would often make statements that seemed intended to offend rather than to educate. In lecturing on education, she told the students that this was science and that the creation story was fiction and superstition. On another occasion, she told students that there was no evidence that God existed and they should stop being anti-intellectual. These comments were totally off the syllabus and well beyond her expertise. She was not educating these students with serious discussions of complex issues, but was confronting them, insulting them, and abusing her position. In the Detroit area, many people, African Americans, poor whites, and others, are hanging on by their fingernails. It is often religion that gives them values, encourages them to pursue education, and keeps them focused. It is a serious offense to undermine what is contributing to their success by expressing contempt for their essential value systems. When we look back at the Scopes trial and the debate over Darwin and evolution, we need to remember two things. First, that the core of the dispute was not evolution, but what values children were going to be taught in school. The second point is that this was a struggle between privileged elites and marginalized populations. The educated urban classes, who monopolized much of the wealth and power in society, had seized control of the structures of society, especially the schools, and were trying to impose their values upon less educated, less privileged, marginalized people. In his summation speech in Dayton, Brian said there are 5,000 scientists in the country. He cited numbers from some professional organization. Half of these people are secular in their religious beliefs. He might also have said, they don't live among us, they don't know us, they don't respect us, they're hostile to our religious and cultural values, and they have contempt for us. Ouch. This is a struggle that has not ended. References to the deplorables or the use of terms such as rednecks, fundies, hillbillies, trailer trash, and yokels reflect the entitlement of the privileged classes and their use of their privilege to denigrate the marginalized classes and religio-cultural groups in our country. In a summation, Bryan said, the Christians are not opposed to science. Christians respect science. Many Christian scientists have made great contributions and will make more, but they want their beliefs to be respected. Okay, let's move out of the past and into the present. Back in 2015, the Pew Research Center did a national public opinion study on these issues. They asked 2,000 people whether they thought humans have existed in their present form since the beginning of time, or have they evolved? The study produced some interesting findings. Most Americans think we have evolved over time, 65% to 31%. Of white mainline Protestants, those would be Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Methodists, Lutherans, etc., disciples of Christ, the ratio is 71% to 23% who think we have evolved. But of white evangelicals, the pattern reverses. 60% think we're the same. 36% think we evolved. Let me repeat that. Of white mainline Protestants, 71% think we have evolved. Of white evangelicals, 60% think we have not evolved. There were also interesting findings on whether people think science and religion are often in conflict or are mostly compatible. Overall, 59% think they are often in conflict, while 38% think they are mostly compatible. But when we look closer, there are surprising findings. Of those who never attend services, 73% think science and religion are in conflict. Of those who attend on a regular basis, only 60% see a conflict. That's a 13% difference that would be statistically significant. Many people would assume the exact opposite, that attending services would produce a charged and even hostile response to science. But the opposite is the case. Having no contact with religion seems to generate a perception of incompatibility. I have just a few final results for that study before I finish. On matters of human life, there are predictable differences by whether or not you attend services and whether you are evangelical or secular. This includes using animals in research and modifying genes to reduce a baby's risk of disease. Secularists and evangelicals are different on those issues. But on most other issues, there is no statistically significant difference between these polar opposite groups, the evangelicals and the secularists. Should we build more nuclear plants? No difference. Is global warming linked to human activity? No difference. Should childhood vaccines be required? No difference. Does government funding for science pay off? No difference. Is growing world population a problem? No difference. Should there be increased use of fracking? No difference. Should there be more offshore drilling? No difference. Is it safe to eat genetically modified foods? No difference. Should there be stricter power plant emission limits? No difference. And dramatically, should we use biologically engineered organs for human transplants? No difference. On all of these issues, evangelicals and secularists are statistically similar. So what are my conclusions? I'm a political scientist. I study and teach on topics of religion and politics. I tell my students that there are political and even religious leaders who benefit from escalating doctrinal conflicts. But I also know that conflicts between religion and science that enter the political realm are often rooted in power conflicts involving class and culture and ethnic interests. These intensify when the broader society takes actions that seem to threaten or endanger the right of local groups to control the training of their youth and to take control of resources such as educational policy that they have traditionally controlled. To paraphrase William Jennings Bryan, it's not just the science, it's also the struggle. Okay, before we sign off, let's have a slight update involving the pandemic using data from the first year. That would be February 2020 through February of 2021. Are evangelicals different? on pandemic issues? Well, yes and no. Evangelicals are likely to see the pandemic as a warning from God. 43% feel that way, but only 28% of Catholics and mainline Protestants. Interestingly, African Americans are the outliers at 47%, 4% above white evangelicals. In a parallel question, among those who believe in God, do you think God will protect you? Whites are at 20%, Latinos are at 34%, with African Americans, again the outliers, at 49%. But those are questions about faith. The real difference is in terms of public policy. This is not religious, but partisan. Is the pandemic a major threat to public health? 82% of Democrats felt that way, but only 41% of Republicans. That is a doubling. 82% of Democrats, 41% of Republicans. Thank you for listening.